welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for being with us today. Coming up in just a bit on a closer look with the monitor, North Dakota lawmakers have launched a new interim committee to study artificial intelligence. But what, if anything, should the state regulate? North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge explains why legislators are now taking a curious but cautious look at a North Dakota first approach. And we begin Main Street today with our friend Matt Olean, who says the movie The Odyssey is destined for Academy Awards. Christopher Nolan has built a career on making ambitious films that challenge audiences, but his latest epic may be his biggest achievement yet. The Odyssey, based on Homer's ancient poem, has become both a critical sensation and a box office phenomenon. Some critics are already calling it the frontrunner for next year's Academy Awards, praising its sweeping visuals, emotional depth, and immersive IMAX experience. But does it really live up to the hype? Well, our film critic Matt Olean thinks so. I think. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig. Good to be with you.
You have called The Odyssey a masterpiece, and that's not a word you use lightly, no. Matt. What makes the film so extraordinary?
Wow. I mean, it is already, I would say, one of the 50 best films I've ever seen. And I don't say that very often. You know, when you're talking about movies that you know that I consider in that upper echelon, you mentioned the Oscars. It's a done deal. You can give Christopher Nolan his second directing Oscar right now. This is my early call. I've had some early calls over the years. This is going to be an early one. Best Picture, Best Director. I think Matt Damon has a good chance to win his first acting Oscar. It's 2 hours, 52 minutes long, but it never feels that way. You know, a lot of us had to read The Odyssey in high school. Homer's The Odyssey. If you don't know the story, it's Odysseus trying to get home after the Trojan Wars, and it takes him a long time to get home. There are obstacles along the way. There's a Cyclops. There's certain gods that are in his way, Poseidon, certain gods that are helping him, certain gods that are hurting him. You know, he's got to avoid mutiny with the men. But I would say the fact that Nolan shot this on 65-millimeter IMAX film, it looks amazing. I mean, that is not normal these days to go out and shoot a film on 65-millimeter. It looks amazing, and the story keeps moving. And I think what he's done is he's removed the gods from the plot. So you hear about the gods, Craig, but you don't see them. Outside of Zendaya as Athena and Charlize Theron as Calypso, you really don't see too many non-human people, non-human forms come to help him or hinder him. So it's really this human drama of Odysseus trying to get home after the Greeks win the Trojan War in Troy. And it just is amazing. It's poignant. The action is there. It's also an art film, a three-hour art film that makes money. Everything about it exceeded my expectations. And this is coming off Oppenheimer 3 years ago, where Nolan wins the Oscar. It's a better film than Oppenheimer. And it's got everything you want in an old-style epic that we used to have, like a Lawrence of Arabia, Ben-Hur, that kind of thing, Spartacus. But it's also got this modern technology of the 65-millimeter IMAX. If you can see it in IMAX, I would. I did not see it in IMAX. But even if you see it, you know, at the Fargo Theater or Century or West Acres or wherever you're at, it's worth seeing in the theater. Do not wait for it to come to streaming. The plot moves very, very, very well. There's been some inaccuracies that have been pointed out that he takes liberties from Homer's text. But again, I always say if you're adapting something from a 4,000-year-old, you know, story or whatever it is, how many thousands of years, you can take some liberties, and some liberties have been taken, but essentially the essence of the story is there. Odysseus's journey to get home, the film never flags. It's always interesting. You know it's going to build to this climax. You know, it's not really a spoiler to say what happens at the end. If people have read this book, they know what's going to happen. I'm not going to say what it is, but it builds to this climax that you know is coming with his return. It's just a phenomenal piece of cinema. The Trojan horse scenes, Craig, oh my goodness. great cinema. And we see it from like three different angles, three different perspectives from the Trojan horse. We see how the men of Troy discover the horse. We see a scene from inside the horse where Matt Damon and the fellows are waiting to get out and attack. And then we see later how they do come out of the Trojan horse. So you get three different perspectives of this iconic scene that everyone's familiar with in literature, and that's the Trojan horse. And, you know, how Nolan shoots those three different perspectives is really amazing, and that those are kind of told in flashbacks because, of course, in the Odyssey, he's trying to get home. But there's some great cinematic stuff going on here, but it's great action film. And, you know, Nolan tries to have things realistic, too. He's not a big CGI guy. He wants realistic sets. Of course, the Cyclops is CGI. There aren't real-life Cyclops hanging around Los Angeles or London waiting for film work, you know? There's a CGI Cyclops, of course. But it's a masterpiece along the lines of A Lawrence of Arabia, I would say.
Matt, I've read where people are really interested in watching this in IMAX. You can't even really do it in Minnesota, and fans in the upper Midwest are generally traveling to places like Indianapolis or Grand Rapids for that format because only a few dozen U.S. theaters can really project it. So I found that interesting. Matt, the other thing that I've wondered about is I've not read the Iliad or the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. I've not done my homework to go see this show. Will I still enjoy it?
Yes. I don't think you have to read these poems, these stories, which are such a cornerstone of modern storytelling and literature, to enjoy this film. In fact, you might like it better if you've not read either the Iliad or the Odyssey. I'm all for artistic license. I mean, there's been some criticism in some quarters of some of the casting, Helen of Troy, the Elliot Page role of Sinan. But overall, you know, Nolan, he's an auteur. He is an auteur director, and he has every right to cast this film the way he wants to cast it. You know, you're not going to cast real Greek actors in this film because, you know, you need a star. You need Matt Damon. You need Anne Hathaway as Penelope. You need Tom Holland as Odysseus's son. Robert Pattinson plays one of the main suitors who wants to marry Penelope. If you're familiar with the story, Craig, you know, Odysseus has been gone so long that back at Ithaca, many suitors want to marry the queen Penelope because they don't think Odysseus is coming back, and she holds them off as best she can. She and her son, played by Tom Holland of Spider-Man fame. So I don't think you have to read the Iliad or the Odyssey to enjoy this movie. It's a great piece of cinema. What I find amazing, you know, Oppenheimer made all that money 3 years ago for Nolan partly because it was paired with Barbie. It was the Barbenheimer weekend. There's no such thing going on here. People are flocking to a three-hour movie. It made $140 million domestic over the last weekend. It's already cleared $300 million worldwide. This is a three-hour movie that's not a franchise, that's not a comic book movie, okay? That's the amazing thing, is that people are going to a film with artistic pretensions that's also an action film. So to me, that gives great hope for cinema. Also, another interesting thing, people like Christopher Nolan, Paul Thomas Anderson, who won the directing Oscar last year for One Battle After Another, this feels like a new era of cinema that we're in, Craig, because these are director-driven films. These are directors who basically can make any film they want. When was the last time that really happened? The 60s and 70s, when we had the new Hollywood with Scorsese and Coppola and Hal Ashby and Robert Altman and Spielberg, director-driven films that eventually went by the wayside in the 80s. And so we're kind of back to that, where people like Chloe Zhao, who made Hamnet last year, Paul Thomas Anderson, Christopher Nolan, they really can open films based on the fact that they're the director. And that's a crazy thing to think about when we think about assembly line type movies like the Marvel films, which I've liked a lot of them, but there's a formula, right? There's a formula that you keep cranking them out. It doesn't really matter who directs the films. This actually feels like it does matter that Christopher Nolan is this auteur, this British director who's become, you know, synonymous with these movies like Memento and the Batman trilogy and Oppenheimer and Dunkirk. He can make a movie based on his name, put big stars in it, and it makes money at 3 hours long. It's amazing that it's caught the public fancy.
Enjoying my conversation with Matt Olien, and he's talking about the movie The Odyssey. Matt reviews movies for us periodically here on Prairie Public. And Matt thinks this is a front runner, or the front runner, for the upcoming Academy Awards. Matt, I'm going to ask you about Matt Damon in just a minute, but I want to ask you about Anne Hathaway, because we've seen her in promoting this show now. She's pregnant. She's expecting. How long does it take to make a show like this? When would have production on The Odyssey started?
This is a long one, and no one warned the cast it's going to be a tough movie. It's going to be a tough shoot. So this took, you know, several years of planning. Matt Damon was given 6 months to kind of work out, and at age 56 to become in shape, but he needed to be Odysseus, a man who can handle himself in action scenes. And he looks great in the movie. Anne Hathaway is very good as Penelope. So this was a lot of years in the making. And again, I go back to the 70s, where someone like Coppola was given a year to shoot Apocalypse Now in the Philippines with, you know, unlimited checkbook. That doesn't happen much anymore. And I've talked about this in my past years on this show, that does not happen much anymore, but now it does, and it paid off for Nolan. So this is someone who leaves no stone unturned as a director, whether it's shooting it in 65mm IMAX, the casting, the realistic sets. The film looks dark in parts, you know, very kind of a darkly lit, because, you know, there was no fluorescent lights back then. So some of the scenes in the banquet hall where the suitors are hanging around and drinking and waiting for Penelope to make a decision on a new husband look very dark, but I could follow them. I could always follow them. So this was a long time in production. You know, I would guess 1 to 2 years probably it took from stem to stern to write the screenplay, get the cast together. You know, they filmed it in various different spots around the world. You know, you have to have the ships, everything. It's really amazing. I think he did a great job with the casting. Again, there's been some criticism of some of the casting. But I think overall, the work that was put into this has paid off.
Matt Damon is an actor, the actor I wanted to get back to, Matt. He's been receiving enormous praise, I think, at least from what I've seen, for his performance in The Odyssey. So what stood out to you about his work? Obviously, he got in shape, but it's so much more. And where does this rank among his career performances? Oscar observers, I think, already also see him as a serious best bet for best actor.
I think he's going to win the Oscar. He does have a screenplay Oscar, you know, years ago for Good Will Hunting. This is, you know, he has said in interviews, this is the part of a lifetime. He's stoic in the film, but he also has to manage these men. So you see the doubt on his face. You see the stress on his face. You see the pain that he's going through after the Trojan War to try to get home. So he conveys all of that. It's not a performance that has a lot of big scenes in terms of him giving speeches to the men, but he's got to be a leader, and he's got to avoid that mutiny where they, you know, run into sirens and sirens, these, you know, creatures that call with their voices to try to get the men toward the rocks, you know, and bad things are going to happen. He's got to get them off the island where the Cyclops is with some trickery. So eventually we do see some big emotional scenes from him. There's a great scene where he is tied to the mast when they're sailing past the sirens, and he wants to hear their song and try to not be tempted by it. And he tells the men, do not untie me, whatever you do. And the men all have wax in their ears so they can't hear the song of the siren. And that's an amazing scene. He is the emotions he conveys in that scene are amazing. I think Damon's a very good actor, underrated, I would say, over the years. He's had some great performances like in The Informant and The Martian. But this is probably the performance of his lifetime and the part of a lifetime when Nolan called him and said, I want you to have the central part in this movie. And he has worked with Nolan before. He was in Oppenheimer, and he was in another film with him as well. I think he was in Inception, if I'm not mistaken about that, or Interstellar, one of the two I films, Inception and Interstellar, that Nolan made. It's a great performance. It's stoic. It's real. It's tortured. And, you know, it's all leading to this big climax. Can he get home or not?
Matt, I've heard this film described by a good friend of mine as loud. And for her, it was a little bit distracting. Did you find it that way?
I did not. Now, Nolan has been criticized in the past for his sound mixing, where it's been hard to understand dialogue. I remember the last scene of Tenet with John Washington and Robert Pattinson saying their goodbye, and you can hardly hear a word they're saying. I think he got the message. You can hear the dialogue. I did not need closed caption on this, which, you know, you can do at theaters. I was able to understand most of the dialogue. I think when the big action scenes happen, yes, it's loud, but I could also hear the dialogue well enough where it was not a huge issue for me. But I've had a couple friends on Facebook complain a little bit about this, but I think Nolan got the message from film fans that you have to have a better sound mix with the dialogue, and I think he did that this time.
All right, we've talked about Best Picture. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Best Actor. How many other awards can this movie win?
I think, you know, cinematography, production design, costumes, sound, editing. If you throw those in the mix, we're already up to 8 awards right there. So it could get to that 8, 9, 10 level. 11 is the record. 11 Oscars won by 3 different films that share the record. I don't know if there's a second acting performance outside of Damon that can win. I do think that Samantha Morton is really good in her cameo role as Circe. She's a wonderful British actress, and Circe is someone in the book and the movie not to be trifled with by the men. If you've read the book or seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. She has some great scenes. I think Tom Holland and John Leguizamo have decent chances to get in the supporting actor mix. Leguizamo plays kind of the soothsayer blind man who's loyal to Odysseus back at Ithaca. So I think 8, 9, 10 is certainly a possibility for this film to win awards. Let's see what happens in the next 5 months. I mean, there could be something that comes along that could challenge it. But what it has is it's got an artistic quality to it by an auteur director, but it's also got popular popcorn appeal for the masses. And that's hard to resist for the Oscar voters.
So does someone like Christopher Nolan, when making a film like this, ask himself the question, all right, who's this for? Mm-hmm. Is it for my devoted fans? Is it for lovers of classic literature? Or is it simply, as I think you alluded to, for someone who wants a great night at the movies and to walk away impressed?
I think what he has done is he's threaded the needle and made this almost for everyone. So I've had a couple of friends of mine who did not want to see this, and now they want to see it. And I wouldn't have thought this was their quote-unquote kind of movie in their wheelhouse. So yes, if you've read the books, you want to go. If you're a Nolan fan, you want to go. If you want a night at the movies with a big, epic film that can still deliver, they want to go as well. And I think just kind of curious people now want to go see what the big deal is all about. I would liken this, like I said earlier, what makes it great, it's an intimate portrait of a man, Odysseus, just like in Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia has this amazing canvas, this desert. Amazing how David Lean made that film. But it's also an intimate portrait of Peter O'Toole, a phenomenal piece of acting as Colonel Lawrence. And that's what I kind of liken this movie to. It's like Lawrence of Arabia. It's a popular, artistic, epic film.
Matt, are there other movies that are on your horizon this summer? Or has this dominated us so much that it's not even worth talking about anything yet?
Oh, there's others coming. I can't, you know, quite put a finger on anything that could approach this. I think Alejandro González Iñárritu's Digger, which is coming later this fall with Tom Cruise, and that's, you can see the trailer if you go to Odyssey. That one has some potential. And if anybody's going to challenge Damon for the Best Actor Oscar, it could be Tom Cruise. If you see the trailer, it's not a typical Tom Cruise performance.
I didn't recognize him, Matt.
You didn't recognize
him. Trailer.
And boy, Oscar voters love it when stars go unrecognizable. So this could be a Matt Damon, Tom Cruise battle for Best Actor. Neither has ever won an acting Oscar. And that could be really, if Digger comes off. Now, Iñárritu, he's another auteur. He did The Revenant and Birdman and all these films, but the last couple he's made haven't quite hit the public fancy. So we'll see if Digger can kind of get into that Oscar mix against Odyssey. I don't see it beating it for Best Picture, but if Tom Cruise hits it out of the park in a part that's not a typical Tom Cruise part, that'll get voters' attention.
Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey is now playing in theaters. Certainly is here in Fargo, and film critic Madeline gives it his highest recommendation. calling it a masterpiece and an early favorite for next year's Academy Awards. As always, Matt, thanks for joining us. We'll see what audiences and eventually Oscar voters have to say in the months ahead.
Thanks, Craig,
for being with us on Main Street.
And one last thing, Craig, for me today, even, you know, as I get older, there's still nothing quite as exhilarating as walking out of the theater when you've just seen something that you didn't expect to see, and it was that good. I think that's the feeling people will get.
You'll have to tell us, Matt, where this actually lands in your top 50 list.
Mm-hmm. I will.
Thanks, Matt.
You bet.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, offering audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery services for conferences, meetings, and live events, serving the Prairie region and clients nationwide. More at LiveWireNow.com.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Welcome back. Technology continues to transform the way we learn. And one of the most fascinating tools at the North Dakota Gateway to Science gives visitors an opportunity to explore the human body in remarkable detail. Anatomage is what it's called, and it's becoming a favorite from everyone, from curious kids to even future medical students. Emily Montgomery from the North Dakota Gateway to Science is back with us. Emily, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Craig?
I'm doing well. All right. We've talked about this before, but tell us again. This is some kind of table.
It is so inspirational and a lot of fun. So our Anatomage table, you will find it over in our Science of You area of our exhibits. And it is a long white table that doesn't look like much until you walk up to it. And you recognize that you can actually do surgery without the mess or liability. So you are able to study human and animal anatomy on our Anatomage table. It's a digital screen. It's two giant screens that are laid flat, and you're able to show the physiology of the human body. So you can see how the heart beats, how joints move, how muscles contract. And it's just a great tool to create lesson content. Like you said so well, Craig, it can be either for elementary age students. We have our medical students at BSC and UMary that will come specifically with their professors for a lesson utilizing this. And it just inspires young visitors interested in medicine as they consider their future careers, because it's a great way just to dissect things without having to worry about it. And they can utilize how to use a scalpel. They can dissect a cat, a rat, a dog, or a human. So it's pretty great. And we actually just had a 13-year-old visitor recently asking to see the human part of it and just seeing the human brain. And she spent quite a long time for a 13-year-old to be very engaged into it. She did amazing. And just being a woman in STEM, she was so interested in it. And as the gallery staff, who does so amazing out there, they were speaking with the girl's grandma, and we found out that her little sister was actually born with a tumor on her trachea and required a lot of medical care during those first 2 years of her life. And she's now doing well, thankfully, but thankfully because of the care she received. And that really inspired her sister to want to become a neonatologist so that she can help other babies like her sister. So it helps solidify for that 13-year-old girl that she loves doing this. So that was a really heartwarming story for us to hear. You never know what people go through walking through our doors. And so giving that chance to just be hands-on.
One of the most surprising aspects of this table is it can work for younger folks, or even medical students, or even older folks who want to come and learn.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be scaffolded so beautifully to reach all different ages, which is one of my favorite parts of the gallery, for sure.
We have to remember that this is not just for people who come to the gallery as students or as people like me who are inquisitive, but educators can build lesson plans around what you offer. Tell me how that works and what makes it such a powerful teaching tool.
Yeah, absolutely. Teachers are more than welcome to. We have different, even if they come to our gallery, our director, Alicia, actually created a really great either scavenger hunt or standards-based worksheets that they can take throughout the gallery. But if they want to use specifically just the Anatomage table, they can create a lesson on to align with their human anatomy standards that they have. The Anatomage will align with that beautifully. Or younger students who are just learning about how different parts of the body function and move. It's a great way to utilize that. So all of it can have lessons based on it, or they can visit our website to utilize the gallery sheets that we have as well for when they come in to do a tour or visit our gallery.
Certainly true that the North Dakota Gateway to Science is one of our state's crown jewels, Emily, and it's also so refreshing to learn that one exhibit can spark a lifelong dream like you just shared with us. So thank you, Emily Montgomery, for sharing with us again today from the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Emily is a STEM educator there. It's on the banks of the Missouri River, and it's a beautiful place to visit. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Still ahead on Main Street, the North Dakota legislature is looking at what AI should look like in the state, and we'll take a closer look with the North Dakota Monitor. That's ahead. Stay with us.
FM Kicks Band presents Jazz Night Saturday, August 1st from 5 to 9 p.m. at 4 and 4 above Side Street. The Jazz Festival follows Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 5 p.m. at Gooseberry Park. Community members of all ages are welcome. Information at fmkicksband.com.
This is a closer look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. Artificial intelligence is changing so quickly that lawmakers across the country are struggling to keep up. Now, North Dakota has created a new legislative committee to study whether the state needs additional safeguards, and if so, what should they look like? It's not writing legislation just yet, but instead members are gathering information, hearing from experts, and looking at how other states are balancing innovation with consumer protection, free speech, and public trust. Jacob Orlich has been covering the committee's work for the North Dakota Monitor, including attending a recent standing room only legislative hearing. Jacob, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
Let's start with the big picture. Why did lawmakers decide now was the time to create this committee? And what problem, if they know, are they trying to solve?
Well, I wouldn't say the problem they're trying to solve is necessarily about AI or about data centers. It's the problem that they want legislators to be more informed and knowledgeable about the subject ahead of the 2027 legislative session, because I think most people would agree that there's going to be some legislation in some form about these subjects that comes up.
And as I said in my open, they're not ready to write a bill just yet, but what did you hear about the mission then of this committee? Gathering information you just talked about, and how will members know if they've been successful by the end of the interim prior to the start of the next legislative session?
I would say that the goal of the committee appears to be developing subject matter expertise, not necessarily to develop legislation on a particular aspect of AI. But the committee does have the power to draft legislation and propose it for the session if they choose to do so at the end of this process. And it's also important to keep in mind that any individual lawmaker can also do so, whether they're on the committee or not.
Committee members talked about a North Dakota first approach to artificial intelligence. What's your perception as to what that means in practice?
Well, that was a comment that was made by Representative Jonathan Worry, who is chairing the Artificial Intelligence Committee. You'd have to ask him to define what he means by North Dakota first in particular, but he did go on to say that innovation is a priority, that they want to make sure that North Dakota is an environment where innovation can thrive, but also protections within reason have to be considered, and public trust is going to be a factor in his view.
The committee, as you reported, spent a fair amount of time looking at what other states have already done. Where do you sense lawmakers are gravitating? Were there other approaches from other states that they seemed particularly interested in, or others that they clearly weren't ready to embrace?
I wouldn't say that anybody on the committee clearly staked out a position or a particular opinion, but they were asking a lot of questions of the subject matter experts who had appeared to present information to them. Those questions focused on transparency of AI use, protecting children, and what form government oversight is taking in some other states that have already taken action.
AI, of course, now touches everything from education to healthcare to elections and other online content. Were there applications Jacob, or concerns that seemed to rise to the top during this meeting?
I wouldn't say there were any concerns that rose to the top necessarily. It was a very broad, overarching overview of what other states have done and what and how AI functions so that lawmakers can better understand what they may be drafting bills on or voting on. They are very much in the information gathering stage.
Protecting children, as you've mentioned already, has been an issue that's appeared to generate broad agreement. But that discussion then also runs into other questions about free speech and First Amendment. Was there much discussion, either from the lawmakers or experts, to provide guidance to navigate those competing concerns?
I think different states are doing different things on this subject. But one thing that came up from multiple presenters is that the topic of protecting children from certain applications of AI is bipartisan in nature, that there are voices on both sides of the aisle and around the country that are advocating for this. There are complications in some aspects. For example, one of the presenters brief lawmakers on what Congress is considering. They explain that some of the provisions have run into potential concerns on First Amendment grounds, but Congress hasn't taken any final action yet, and it still remains to be seen if any of that comes to fruition.
This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and artificial intelligence is changing fast. Jacob Orlidge is covering the issue for the North Dakota Monitor. We visit weekly in a segment we call A Closer Look with the Monitor about issues that are important to the state of North Dakota. And of course, Jacob Orlidge is the reporter that I'm visiting with today. Another recurring theme was enforcement. I think some lawmakers questioned whether many AI regulations were even enforceable. And is that becoming one of the biggest challenges, not deciding whether to regulate AI, but figuring out what government can realistically regulate?
I think that was a question that was brought up by Representative Todd Porter. He asked if some of the broader legislation that had been passed in states like California or Colorado was even legal. And I believe the point he was trying to make was that it could be a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause, that because AI is crossing state lines, do states even have the power to enforce some of the regulations that are being passed in other states? And that's an open question. I believe, if I recall correctly, the presenter in that case mentioned that it was going to be a question answered by the courts at some point. So TBD.
For someone who's listening today and who isn't following AI policy, Jacob, as closely as you do, where could future regulations actually impact their everyday life? What kinds of decisions or interactions might look different if North Dakota were to eventually act?
There are a laundry list of potential impacts that people could see both from AI and regulations of AI. It could be requirements to disclose if a product or a process like employment hiring uses AI. It could be age verification to use AI tools like chatbots, AI use in schools, AI use by government agencies, political advertisements that are generated by AI, deepfakes, which are images that are generated by AI. Cybersecurity concerns are also a big thing. All of these are topics that could potentially come up and have come up in other states to one degree or another.
And because they've come up in other states, Jacob, I think you're absolutely right mentioning that federal policy adds another layer. Congress is considering a variety of proposals. And I think the Trump administration has signaled it prefers a lighter regulatory approach. So how much does that uncertainty really complicate what states like North Dakota and what North Dakota's legislature maybe hopes to do after this interim committee has maybe met for another time or two?
It's a very big unknown. And the big question when it comes to potential federal regulation is the question of preemption, whether the federal regulation will preempt what states have done and require states to follow the federal government's regulatory scheme instead of potentially stricter requirements that they have or would put in place. And that's still a very big unknown. We don't know what Congress is going to do.
The meeting you reported about had more than 70 people in attendance. It was the committee's very first meeting. And Lawmakers even invited written testimony from the public. It's not something they do all the time for an interim committee. Jacob, what did that tell you about the level of public interest or concern surrounding AI? What did the people say?
I think the public's interest, at least based on the people who attended and spoke at that committee meeting, is more focused on the second half of the committee's name, which is data centers, rather than AI. That was the focus of the public comment. That was what I believe many of the people in the room were present for. And there's a lot of concern about data centers and data center siting and energy use in North Dakota, and that concern is only growing here. By my count, we now have three legislative committees that are looking at data centers in one form or another. We've got this committee. The Energy Committee is looking at it from the perspective of large load energy consumers and their effect on the grid, and the Tax Relief Committee, I believe, is looking at tax incentives for data centers. So it's a popular topic in and out of government.
Jacob, as a reporter who sat through the meeting, what surprised you the most? Was there anything that challenged even your own assumptions about where this debate might be headed? Or on the flip side, was there an important issue you expected to hear more about that just barely came up during the meeting?
I would say I was somewhat surprised by the fact that data centers were not a bigger focus of the meeting. Now, there are going to be five meetings of this committee, according to the chairman. So it could be that this is going to be a heavier focus down the road before the legislative session. But data centers do appear to be the larger concern for the North Dakota public, from what I am aware of. And the fact that only a few presentations, most of which were relatively short, were on data centers, and the bulk of the committee hearing was focused on artificial intelligence, that was a slight surprise to me.
As the committee prepares to meet again next in August, Jacob, what do you think North Dakotans should be watching for? Is it this data center discussion? Is it more policy refinement relative to AI and its use and impact here in North Dakota? Are there big questions, obviously, that still need answers before the lawmakers decide anything at all? What do you think will be the focus in the short term, and what should we be watching for?
I think, as the lawmakers and as legislative council put it, this is a rapidly evolving topic, both here in North Dakota and across the country. And there are going to be a lot of changes from now to the legislative session in January. What those changes are going to be, how the situation is going to look 6 months from now when legislators are potentially considering legislation on these topics, it's anybody's guess at this point. So I would say keep an eye on what these committees are doing, and keep an eye out for potentially further data center announcements here in North Dakota. I don't have any information on that or when those might be, but it certainly seems to me that every time I turn around, there's another piece of news on these subjects. So I would just keep your ears open.
Isn't that the truth? In fact, I would steer readers to a New York Times article that appeared 2 days ago on the 21st about OpenAI saying that its AI models went rogue and attacked a digital library. It gets into the weeds just a little bit, but boy, Jacob, it sure highlights some of the outstanding issues that are going to be important to all of us as we watch this issue continue. Jacob Orlidge is a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. You can read his reporting on this story and many others at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. North Dakota Monitor is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization, and all of its reporting is available free of charge with no subscriptions or paywalls. Jacob, it's always a pleasure to visit. Thanks for joining A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me on, Greg.
The Trowood Performing Arts School presents Disney's Frozen, July 20th through August 1st at Bluestem Center for the Arts in Moorhead. Directed by Trowood alumna and Broadway performer Becky Galsvig. Information at trowood.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
It's Thursday here on Main Street, and although we haven't been able to do it for a while, it's great to have our news director, Dave Thompson, back with us to review North Dakota news. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Good to be back.
Dave, North Dakota oil prices have climbed to more than $100 a barrel. Of course, that's primarily because of the war in Iran, and this isn't the first time that it's been there. This increased cost of oil is bringing tens of millions of unanticipated money to the state. What's the latest?
Well, the latest we know of, these were the main numbers that climbed to over $100 per barrel. And the director's cut report where we got it, that lags by about 2 months because it takes some time for the oil companies to, you know, submit their reports. But we think there could be some more coming to watch the oil prices. And I don't know if you're seeing it too, but it looks like maybe gas prices have slipped over $4 a gallon in North Dakota.
Well, Dave, you reported then that $29 million is what was new to the state in May, so we'll certainly have to watch those numbers.
The interesting thing about that, though, is that if we're getting an extra $29 million, and if this stays up, then maybe the state won't have to do, you know, like the budget reductions that the governor outlined in his budget guidelines to state agencies. So that's worth watching. It's worth watching for every month when they do the reports about the cost and how much has been pumped out of the ground. The one thing that came out is that we're still a bit behind the revenue forecast in terms of the amount of oil that's been pulled out of the ground, but in terms of the dollars per barrel, we're doing very well.
Dave, the state-owned North Dakota mill profits for fiscal year 2026 have declined slightly from fiscal year 2025. What's the latest there?
Well, the latest is it's kind of like the economic slowdown. You know, the mill and elevator does a lot of flour for restaurant chains. And as people see their budgets being squeezed a little bit because of the higher cost of things, they're not going out to eat as much. So some of that has been a reduction in what their profit is. Plus, they also sell Dakota-made flour. I don't know if they've gotten it broken out yet about how that's doing versus the flour that they send to more commercial operations. But it's interesting, and the mill is actually doing pretty well. It met three of its four target goals. It missed one. Part of the profits go back to the employees based on, you know, meeting these things. So it'll be a little less than they got last year where they met all four of the goals, but they're still going to get some kind of reward for meeting three of the goals.
Today, the North Dakota Health and Human Services is preparing to implement federal work requirements for some enrolled in Medicaid expansion, and Interim Medicaid Director Krista Fremming has really been trying to get the word out about that.
That's right, and she thinks it's going to be between 5,000 and 7,000 people. These new work requirements are going to be in effect. You either have to find a job or do some volunteer work or do some training to show that you are looking for work or willing to participate in another way. And this is part of the One Big Beautiful Bill that was passed.
On to the headline, the United States Supreme Court is to hear now a North Dakota property rights case. Give us the details.
What we know is that WBI Energy had a pipeline dispute with some landowners. The company used eminent domain to take a portion of their properties for a pipeline project. This dates back to 2018. Now, they're okay to do that. They say, you know, you can use eminent domain in certain cases, but the landowners are saying, hey, wait a second, you know, what about our rights in this? So it's going to the U.S. Supreme Court. This could be very interesting, and this is going to be one to watch.
In your Do You Know Dak newsletter, everyone can subscribe to that, and we encourage them to do that at prairiepublic.org. You recently took a trip to northern Minnesota to learn about a proposal for a plan in Minot. What's that about?
Well, this is iron from spoil piles from iron mining in the iron mining area of Minnesota, up there near Hibbing. Now, they're going to take the spoil piles, which actually do have iron ore in them. They have a process that they developed to extract the iron ore. They're taking it to Minot because Minnesota is a little harder to get this, get the permits through. North Dakota is a little bit more friendly to get permits for this. And so they've got rail service going from the Iron Range to Minot. Building the plant in Minot helps the Minot economy. And then they can ship it by rail to steel producers. This is a pig iron for steel, which is, I found it very fascinating. And they are talking about reclamation. As a matter of fact, the company that's actually doing it has reclamation in its name.
All right, Dave, we'll look forward to that. Of course, that will be more jobs then for the Minot area.
Absolutely.
Dave, what are you and your news team working on?
I'm working on stories about road construction updates and, you know, some other things that I've been kind of interested in. And I'm going to leave you with this. Did you know that North Dakota did have voter registration?
I did not, but I'm new here.
It was repealed in 1951. There is a Dakota date book on this, but I found it very interesting. And I'm looking at maybe having a historian talk about what was the dynamic in the 1951 legislature. And I'm going to make a guess for you. It might be part of the rise of the nonpartisan league. They were trying to decide, should they be a part of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or their own?
That's Dave Thompson. He's Prairie Public's news director. He and I review the news periodically here on Main Street. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 23rd. Grant was impressed with Dakota Territory when he ventured onto the Great Plains in 1883. During his stop in Fargo, Grant said, "I came out here to be impressed, but I see greater evidence of enterprise in your city and prosperity in your country than I anticipated, and all promise of great things for the future. Although I've crossed the United States much and visited nearly every territory as well as state, this is the first time I have ever set foot on Dakota soil. I'm glad to be on so solid and substantial a foundation." Grant is best known as a Civil War hero and the general credited with defeating the Confederacy. He served as president from 1869 to 1877. While he was widely regarded as a hero for his Civil War service, his record as president was more uneven. He also had a contentious relationship with the original inhabitants of Dakota Territory. As president, he tried to enact a peace policy intended to settle conflicts with Native Americans by encouraging them to give up their traditional way of life and adopt Euro-American customs. His vision of peace was upended when George Armstrong Custer's expedition discovered gold in the Black Hills and prospectors flooded into what was supposed to be the Great Sioux Reservation. Ulysses S. Grant died on this date in 1885. Dakota newspapers printed pages of condolences from famous and influential figures as well as ordinary citizens. People offered their services to assist with the funeral. His Civil War comrades remembered him as a capable and inspiring leader. Dakota Territory Governor Pierce issued a proclamation calling Grant the foremost citizen of our time, and noting that such lives are rare. Few men are permitted to render such service, to gain such renown, to merit such distinction. In his victories, the people rejoiced. In his misfortune, they sorrowed. And in his death, they mourned. Grant left behind a mixed legacy. He was fondly remembered for his service during the Civil War, if not for his less than stellar presidency. As they mourned the passing of a former president and military hero, many Americans tended to overlook his shortcomings. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Planned Parenthood, offering health education for teens and workshops for parents on topics including health, relationships, and growing up. More at ppncs.org.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us.
Monday on the show, wildfire smoke and extreme heat remind us that many of the forces shaping our lives originate far beyond our control. But if we can't choose the circumstances, what do we owe ourselves in response? We'll discuss in our monthly Philosophical Currents with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein from the University of North Dakota. Until then, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you again Monday right here on Main Street.